All right, let's open up our Bibles to 2 Corinthians, chapter 2. 2 Corinthians, chapter 2, and verse 11. I want to spend just a little bit of time this morning talking about understanding the tactics of the enemy, Satan. Because of so much information that we've been hit with in the last several weeks, especially about all these terror attacks, and a lot of people are using fear to further agendas, I think, not only within religious realms, but also in political realms as well, to sort of get an understanding of what kind of ideology and people that we're dealing with. If you read back with the early church fathers, and I do love to read them, one of the things you'll find about them is they had a good grasp and an understanding of what the people around them believed, the pagans. They understood a lot of their systems of belief, and it gave them the ability then to be able to approach them in a way to unlock doors for the gospel to be able to penetrate their cultures and their societies. They didn't walk just blindly in many times, but they had an understanding and a grasp and of what the people understood and believed. And a lot of people are hearing a lot today about Islam, about ISIS, all of these groups. And all we know is, you know, from a general mentality, oh, these are bad people and they're out to, you know, get us. But we don't really understand why they believe like they believe, why they act like they act, and how they think, and understanding their mentality and why they feel the way that they feel about us, about other religions. And so what I want to do is just spend a little time this morning just kind of educating us in a sense, because Paul does say here to us in 2 Corinthians, as he's writing to the Corinthians in verse 11, he talked about the fact that he did not want them to be taken advantage of by Satan, because he didn't want them to be ignorant of his schemes. He didn't want them to be ignorant of his devices and the mannerisms and the plans and the schemes that he lays out. And again, idea there, schemes is plans not only for them personally, individually, schemes that he had to be able to work out to bring them into deception and bondage and trip them up and take them down, but as well as ideologies around them that they were facing so that they would not be snared and taken captive by these schemes. So what I want to do is just spend a little time talking about that this morning. Maybe it'll help you have an understanding of when you hear things, some of the things that are being said, some of the things that are being reported, some things that are being reported that are being reported truthfully, other things that are being reported that are not being reported truthfully but are being used and manipulated in order to get you to think a certain way, because there's agendas that are trying to be put forth and things carried out to meet certain people's ends ultimately. One of the things that we know that we're facing is this whole issue of Islam. And basically, let's just get a crash course in that. Not a thorough course, obviously. It'd take years to do that. But an idea of just basically, who are these people? What do they believe? What do they think? One of the things you have to understand is that a person who is Islamic, who is a Muslim, every single area of their life is dictated by their religion. Every area. Not just portions of it. You know, a lot of times, like Christians, we like to take, you know, Christianity and slice it up like a pie, and we want to say that this part, you know, applies for my life, but I can do the rest of what I want to. But for them, if they are committed to their faith, every single solitary area, whether it's political, family, religious, their business, sexual, war-making, everything is dictated by their religious beliefs. Their religion is built upon five pillars, five basic things. One of those, first pillar, is the Quran, their teaching, and that Muhammad is the prophet of God. He is God's man. That's pillar number one. Second pillar for them is obviously is prayer, and you're going to pray the five times a day. Third pillar for them is almsgiving, that they're going to give and help other people. Another pillar for them is the whole issue of fasting, which you hear a lot about with them. And then, of course, being able to go ultimately on pilgrimage to Mecca. That's if you're able, at some point, at least once in your life, you're supposed to be able to go to Mecca and make pilgrimage there, Hajj. So these are the five things that it is all based upon. Now, you can look at these and you say, well, hey, a lot of religions have prayer and a lot of religions have alms, fasting, even pilgrimages to places. That's true. But the one thing that sets this apart is this one. This is the main pillar here. This is the foundation, that it is the teachings of the Quran and that Muhammad is God's prophet. He is the one. And in order to really understand Islam, you have to understand Muhammad, because everything in that religious system is based around his character, his teaching, and who he is, and the revelations that were supposedly given to him by Allah. Now, Allah, contrary to what a lot of people believe, is not Yahweh. Allah is not Jesus. In fact, when Muhammad showed up in Mecca in order to and began to try to convert these people, Allah had been in existence a long time before this as a pagan deity. In fact, they used the term Allah for the number one ranking deity of all the pagan gods. Whoever that number one ranking deity was, they gave him the title Allah. And at that time, when he showed up in Mecca, it was the moon god. And so Allah, when you hear that, even though some people tell you, oh, it's the same God as the God of Abraham, the God of Moses, the God of David, it's not. That name was a title that was adopted by them as the, and originally was associated with paganism. The Quran, though, the teachings that were given to Muhammad is what so much of this is based upon. And according to the Quran, how this book came into existence, it was supposedly a series of revelations that were given to Muhammad by the angel Gabriel. And he was given these revelations, and then Muhammad was to dictate these revelations to his followers. And so Muhammad's companions who were with him memorized huge portions of his teachings and then began to write them down with whatever was at hand. And then to begin to compile those things together as his teachings. The Quran is about the size of the Christian New Testament. It's made up of about 114 surahs, which are like chapters. And it contains his writings, his teachings, and it's not to be confused with the Sirah or the Sunnah, which is called the Hadith, which is basically the life of Muhammad and the sayings of Muhammad. The Quran is separate, but those trilogy of those three things, Quran, the Sirah, and the Hadith, those are the trilogy that they pull the bulk of their system of what they believe and why and how they live their lives. And so he was supposedly given this revelation by the archangel Gabriel. And he was given that over a period of years. While he was in Mecca, he condemned paganism. He wanted the people there to be monotheists. He wanted them to worship one God. At the beginning, he was very tolerant with Jews and Christians because they were monotheists. They believed only in one God. But at a point in time when they rejected him, especially the Jewish rabbis who were there, when they rejected him as being a quote-unquote prophet from God and they would not receive him, he turned and, of course, began to develop an ideology against them, specifically because of their belief, not only just in the one God, but the Christians who believed in the Trinity and believing that God manifested himself in three distinct persons, yet one soul essence. But he began to persecute the Jews and the Christians as well. And he left from Mecca and eventually ended up in Medina. And there he transformed Islam from being a benign religious system that was very passive in the very beginning to expand it into a material and political and military ideology the way that it is today. In Islam, Muhammad is considered the ideal man. He is considered the example, the pattern to follow for all Muslims. He's not considered divine. There are no images of him. They're not allowed to worship Muhammad. But nonetheless, he is the excellent standard by which all Muslims should measure themselves in how they live, in their teachings, their actions, everything. His teachings make up what is called, as I said, the Sunnah, which means the way of the Prophet, and how he lived his lives. And through reading those things, these Islamic believers are able to discern what is a good and right life if they practice these things daily. How he lived, what he did, the things that he said, his personal habits. They're indispensable knowledge for any Muslim who considers themselves to be faithful to Islam. These sunnah or these hadiths, they are again recorded about Muhammad's life, and they were passed down orally until about the 8th century when they began to be written down. And then there was a lot of dispute about, well, which ones are authentic, which ones are not authentic. And they had to weed through all of that. And they eventually came through a collection compiled by Sahih al-Bukhari. And he compiled these things together, and they are recognized by most, he's recognized by most Muslims as the one who compiled the authentic hadith or the teachings of Muhammad. Because Muhammad himself is the measuring stick for all morality. His actions are not allowed to be judged by any standard outside of him. You don't take Muhammad and then the teachings, ethical teachings of, let's say, the Bible, and send him up and compare him to them. No, no, no. The teachings of the Bible have to be compared to the ethical standard of Muhammad. He is the rule. He is the rule of thumb and the ethical and moral standard for what a Muslim properly is. You hear a lot about this today as well. You hear a lot about Sharia law. Everywhere in Islamic countries, and of course you've got branches of Islam, predominantly you have the Shia and the Sunni, which if you would compare it to Christianity, is two different denominations within Islam, different systems of belief. The Shia make up the minority of the people that are Islamic. Sunnis make up the majority. ISIS, those people that you're hearing about, a lot of the terrorists predominantly are Sunni Muslims. But you hear a lot about Sharia law. This is a legal and a political plan based upon the Quran and the teachings of Muhammad. And it means, Sharia means the way, the path. Basically, this is how you live and conduct life in society. They're derived, as I said, from the commandments of the Quran and from the teachings of, and the hadith and the sunnah of Muhammad. The Quran and the sunnah, they establish all the dictates. That is the blueprint for a good Islamic society. Anywhere and everywhere Islamic people groups gather and become, especially the predominant group, they are going to be ruled or want to be ruled ultimately, if they're going to be good Muslims, by Sharia law. And they're going to enforce Sharia law in that society. And it dictates everything about their life. It's not optional. It is the legal code, they believe, from Allah to all mankind, and that every single human being on this planet should be living under this, because Allah wills it. That is what they believe, and that is what they are committed to, ultimately. And so to violate that, to not accept Sharia law and its authority, is to commit rebellion against Allah. It is to shake your fist in His face, and Allah's faithful are required to combat and fight against everybody who would resist Sharia law, and ultimately to destroy them if they will not submit. Islam itself means submissive, surrender, or to submit. And so this is very, very, very important. Sharia law is basically divided up into two sections. You've got the areas that have to do with the acts of worship, prayer, the alms, the fasting, pilgrimage, and so forth. And then Sharia has to do with human interaction, how we relate to each other, and how Muslims relate to themselves and to kafir, which are unbelievers, those who are not adherents to Sharia law. But it dictates how they deal with their financial transactions, how they, their endowments, laws of inheritance, marriage, divorce, childcare, food, drink, including how the people are, animals are slaughtered and how things are hunted, penal punishments, war, how it's to be conducted, peace, judicial matters, including witnesses and forms of evidence. The Quran divides people, all humanity, into two groups. The two groups are this: believers, those who adhere to the Quran, to the Hadith, to the Sirah, the Sunnah, those people, and then everyone else who are considered to be kafir. Okay, you see this sometimes, and you'll hear them talk about this. You'll see them refer to people as kafir. And these people are unbelievers. These are non-believers. These are non-Muslims. Two-thirds of the Quran, 81% of the Sunnah or the teachings of Muhammad deal with kafir-related issues. How you relate to and deal with the non-believer. Those who will not accept Muhammad as the prophet, those who do not accept the Quran, those who do not and will not live under Sharia law. According to Islamic law, Sharia, Quran, the Sunnah, according to that, anyone who is an unbeliever, a kafir, can be enslaved, a kafir can be raped, a kafir can be beheaded, deceived, plotted against, terrorized, warred against, and humiliated. But here's the thing you must remember. Stated, a kafir must never be the Muslim's friend. Never. An unbeliever, non-believer, is not allowed to be a kafir's friend or a Muslim's friend. Now, you say, wait a minute, and we'll see that in a minute. Well, I know people, I do too. I've met them. My daughter used to deal a lot with Islamic people. You say, well, they're nice people. They're good people. Some of them have been really, really nice to me. And we'll see why in a minute. But the teachings, if they're faithful to believe what Islam teaches, they can never, ever, ever be the friend of a kafir. Never. And that's very important to remember. When you look at what it teaches about the kafir, the unbelievers, according to the Quran, chapter 40, verse 35, they, kafirs, who dispute the signs or the verses in the Quran of Allah without authority having reached them are greatly hated by Allah and the believers. So Allah seals up every arrogant and disdainful heart. Muslims are allowed, as I said, to enslave the kafir. Sahih Bukhari says this, when some of the remaining Jews in Medina agreed to obey a verdict from Sa'id, Muhammad sent for him. He approached the mosque riding a donkey. This is from the life of Muhammad. And Muhammad said, stand up for your leader. Muhammad then said, Sa'id, give these people your verdict. Sa'id replied, their soldiers should be beheaded and their women and children should become slaves. And this is why you see when ISIS goes into many of the places that it does, all the men are slaughtered and the women and children are kept. Most of the time for sex slaves. Because they're allowed to do that. A Muslim may rape a kafir. In Ishaq 125, it says, on the occasion of Kabar, Muhammad put forth new orders about forcing sex with captive women. If the woman was pregnant, she was not to be used for sex until after the birth of the child. Nor were any women to be used for sex who were unclean with regard to Muslim laws about menstruation. A Muslim may behead a kafir. You wonder why you see all this so many times on the television. In the Quran, chapter 47, verse 4, when you encounter the kafir on the battlefield, cut off their heads until you have thoroughly defeated them, and then take the prisoners and tie them up firmly. A Muslim may deceive, lie to, and trick a kafir. This is considered moral. This is considered right. Chapter 6, verse 25 of the Quran. Some among them listen to you, Muhammad, but we have cast veils over there, the kafirs' hearts, and a heaviness to their ears so that they cannot understand our signs in the Quran. You wonder why you hear speeches given by Islamic leaders to the West saying one thing, and then when they are speaking to their own people in their own culture and their society and their land, they're saying something completely different. Why you used to be able to see Yasser Arafat stand up on one hand and talk about wanting peace with the Jews, and then on the other hand, listen to him make speeches to the Palestinians talking about driving them into the sea. Why? Because they believe it is morally right to be deceptive and lie to the kafir. So they cannot be trusted. And why? We have Western leaders and we've got Islamic people who have left Islam telling them, you are being lied to. You can't trust these people. They're going to tell you what you need to hear, what they think you need to hear, and what they want to hear in order to get ultimately what they want. Case in point, the Iranians with a nuclear deal. They will tell you exactly what, but according to Islamic teaching, they have a moral obligation to lie to you and to deceive you as a kafir. They're allowed to do that. Not only that, a Muslim can plot against, plan evil against a kafir. According to the Quran 86 verse 15, they plot and scheme against you, Muhammad, so I plot and scheme against them. Therefore, deal calmly with the kafirs and leave them alone for a while we plot against. A Muslim may terrorize the kafir. Quran 8 verse 12. Then your Lord spoke to his angels and said, I will be with you. Give strength to the believers. I will send terror into the kafir's hearts, cut off their heads and even the tips of their fingers. You have to understand again, this group particularly, ISIS, is committed literally to a 7th century way of thinking and living. And they are committed to practices that were very relevant, tortures even, to the relevant in the 7th century. When you have eyewitnesses last week talking about some of these people who were shot in that theater there in Paris, and while these two individuals were standing there, each one very methodically taking out individuals, and then while these people were dying, gutting them in front of people standing there watching. This was, again, practice. They believe this is right before Allah. And they have the right and legitimate legal authority, according to the Quran, to do it. A Muslim can make war and humiliate against the kafir. Quran chapter 9 verse 4 says, make war on those who have received the scriptures. Talking about our Bible. Make war on them who have and who do not believe in Allah or in the last day. They do not forbid what Allah and His messenger have forbidden. The Christians and Jews do not follow the religion of truth until they submit and pay the poll tax. And they are humiliated. A Muslim must never, according to the Quran, befriend a kafir. Believers, according to Quran chapter 3 verse 28, should not take kafirs as friends in preference to other believers. Those who do this will have none of Allah's protection and will only have themselves as guards. Allah warned you to fear Him, for all will return to Him. So those are just, again, that's just some basic understanding. You and I would be considered kafir. The people of this country, what they refer to or believe to be the great Satan, are a nation of kafirs. We are the unbeliever, but we are to be converted. If we will not convert, we will die. You wonder why they go into so many of the places that they do, even among Islamic nations, and slaughter their own, because they consider many of the Muslims who are over there apostate. If you're apostate, you're a kafir. You die. If you don't repent and convert and return back to the teachings of Allah, to the Quran, to the Hadith, all of those things, and you don't do that, you die. Doesn't matter that you're Assyrian, like I'm Assyrian. It doesn't matter that you're an Iranian, like I'm an Iranian. If you're not going to follow the way of teachings in the Quran and Allah, you will die. There are over 109 verses in the Quran that call Muslims to war with the kafir. The Quran states in chapter 9, verse 36, and kill them wherever you find them. Turn them out from where they have turned you out. You are commanded to fight, although you dislike it. You may have something that is good for you and love something that is bad for you. Allah knows and you do not. But if they turn back, find them, kill them wherever they are. Do not be unjust to yourselves regarding them, but fight the kafirs as they fight you all together. Sahih Bukhari says, I have commanded to fight people until they testify that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah, and perform the prayer and pay zakat. If they say it, they have saved their blood and possessions from me, except for the rights of Islam over them, and their final reckoning is with Allah. Participation in jihad. Jihad doesn't mean holy war, it means the struggle. And it's always usually been associated with holy war. A lot of times they say they're in jihad. First of all, the most important jihad they feel like is their own personal self, that they have to deal with themselves, personally, their character. But then secondly, they see jihad as enforcing Islamic law across the world and being in war against those who are kafir. It's a personal obligation for every single Muslim who is committed to the faith. A jihadist can only leave if he's ill, if he's wounded, if he's without a weapon, or when the Muslim force faces an enemy at least twice its size. There is a communal obligation for every Muslim to participate in jihad, even though he may not go to the battlefield, but he will support jihad with his finances. He will funnel money to those who are doing the fighting. It says, he who provides the equipment for a soldier in jihad has himself performed jihad, Muhammad said. That is likely a comforting statement for the people who are the Saudi princes right now, who are funneling money to these people. Princes and other of our supposedly allied states who are funneling money to these people to do jihad against the West and all the kafir. There's no comparison an Islamic believer feels to being a part of jihad and fighting against the kafir. Why today are there over 90 countries, why people are running and joining this group called ISIS, thousands of volunteer people, even from our own nation, who are joining up with them in order to fight the unbelievers. The Quran says in chapter 4, verse 95, believers who stay at home in safety, other than those who are disabled, are not equal to those who fight with their wealth and their lives for Allah's cause. Allah has ranked those who fight earnestly with their wealth and lives above those who stay at home. Allah has promised good things to all, but those who fight for Him will receive a far greater reward than those who have not. So their ideology teaches them that, look, if you're going to be a good Muslim, you're going to participate in jihad wherever you are against unbelievers. That jihad may take the form of you taking up weapons and fighting them. That jihad may take the form of you simply penetrating a community, and by virtue of time and years, filling that community by birth rates and by other people being brought in with a Muslim majority in order to change it and transform it and infiltrate it and change things to Sharia law in that area, wherever they may be. You see this happening in places in Europe right now, where the majority now has become Islamic in certain suburbs, places, small villages and towns in European cities, where now Sharia law is being imposed upon those who live there. So you look at this and say, okay, here's these basic things that these folks believe, and certainly this is not extensive, but it kind of gives you an understanding of where these guys are coming from, where the typical Muslim is starting from. But where does ISIS, this group that is so prominent now in the news, where do they come from? Where did they originate? Well, it stands, the term ISIL, which our president is fond of wanting to call them, stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. They renamed themselves in 2014 to the Islamic State, and they have proclaimed the creation of a global caliphate, which they themselves will be in control of. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, their leader since 2010, has declared that he is the new caliph, and as such, he now rules all Muslims. He's the one. Now, of course, all Muslims aren't recognizing his rule, but he declares himself to be the one who rules all Muslims. It's not been welcomed by a lot of the Arabic countries over there as well, as you know. They were founded ultimately or originally in 1999 by the Jordanian extremist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Within 5 years, Zarqawi's new group chose to associate themselves with Osama bin Laden and with Al-Qaeda. They're considered to be very extreme Islamists, jihadists. They're very committed to jihad and to this struggle. There are a lot of groups that they have tied in, and there are similar groups to them. The Taliban you hear about, Boko Haram, which you've heard about this week in Africa, and the terrorist strikes there, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah. They've also made the news, but ISIS appears from a lot of people's mindset, and of course, I think truthfully so, in a league of its own, all by itself, in the way that they are carrying out jihad. Al-Qaeda disassociated themselves in 2014 from ISIS. They said, hey, we're not a part of this. We don't want anything to do with you. And now this new group became its own self-sustained entity because Al-Qaeda considered ISIS too extreme. And yet what ISIS is doing is simply being fully committed in totality to fundamental Islamic teaching. Totally. They continue to advance, as you know, throughout the Middle East and are spreading around the world, and it is a force, as we know, to be reckoned with. They follow a very extreme form of Islam known as Salafism. It means the pious forefathers. That's why they are committed not just to recent teachings, but to the ancient teachings. And it promotes violence and bloodshed. They promote it and encourage it in order to establish and maintain the hegemony of the Quran, the control of the Quran, through a very strict adherence to the Quran and to Sharia law wherever they are. They have a very strong apocalyptic belief about the end times. They believe that chaos and confusion and disruption has to occur globally for their Mahdi to come, their Savior, to return and establish Islamic law globally, Sharia law globally, for everyone to follow and adhere to and obey for all the ages to come. But before the Mahdi can come, confusion, chaos, mass terror, you name it, has to happen. So he can come and establish and fix the situation. ISIS has declared jihad against all infidels, all unbelievers. That includes Westerners, Christians, Jews, but it also includes other Muslims who do not pledge allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as the new caliph. If they don't say they're committed to him, they die. They're also a militia. They're well-trained in guerrilla warfare. They've shown great organizational skills from a military standpoint, shocking, especially to a lot of military leaders in the West. It seems, most of the time when you have these groups rise up in third world countries like that, there seems to be a lot of corruption, chaos, and military inadequacy. Usually that's the norm, you know, they just kind of roll over and die. But this isn't the case with a lot of these guys, and there's a very simple reason why it is not. Their rapes, their beheadings, their crucifying of Christians in places, that's all well known to us. What they want to do is intimidate. They want to paralyze the world into an inability to respond to them appropriately. They want people to live in fear of them. They know how to use social media, social networks on the internet to spread their propaganda of terror, as well as recruit fighters from all over the world. It knows no boundaries. There are no walls for this group as far as who they're able to attract. And they can attract people from countries and are attracting people from countries all over the world. They go to the Middle East, they're trained, and then they are sent back to their respective countries in order to carry out jihad wherever they're from. It doesn't matter if they're from the United States, it doesn't matter from the Europe, whatever. They're sent back in order to carry out jihad. They worship, and their ideology is built upon death. It is built upon bloodshed and making war against all the kafir. See, they believe, as I said, that with all of these murders and things that they're doing, the hatred and the gruesome acts, they think, or the Westerners think, oh, if these people weren't so poor, if they weren't so, you know, hard off in that place, they wouldn't be doing these terrible things. But again, they understand that the only way they can emerge victorious is to slaughter the unbelievers again, create all this mass confusion and so forth, so that the Mahdi can return. They believe that Jesus, they believe he was a good prophet. They don't deny his existence. They believe he's a good prophet, but they don't believe he was crucified, dead, and resurrected. They believe that Allah deceived people to make people think that Jesus was crucified. He was taken away, but one day he'll return before the Mahdi, and he will start establishing, he'll get married, he'll have kids, he'll start establishing Sharia law in preparation for the Mahdi and getting him ready. They certainly do not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. They believe that Christianity is a corrupt religious teaching. Pagan, and it's evil, and it has to be eradicated. That's why the Christians are under such persecution by these people in the Middle East. But what's interesting is when you talk to military veterans who have been in Iraq and Afghanistan, especially those who oversaw the taking of prisoners of war, one person that I know shared this. He said, making the prison camps the way that we did, he said, was a huge mistake. We housed key jihadists together where they were free to plot and plan what they would do after the Americans would eventually free them. Here's what I was told. Interesting perspective directly from the front line. This is a lesson I'll share with you from my time with these, and I won't say what he said. 8 years ago, I spent 9 months with them. I regret Camp Buka and the ISIS it created. I will say what they told me. They said, this is going to happen because all they needed was time. That what is going on today. They were called Takfiri. That refers to a Sunni Muslim who looks at the world in black and white. There's no gray. They are the true believers and there are non-believers with no shades in between. And a Takfiri's mission is to recreate the caliphate according to the literal interpretation of the Quran. So we got there in 2007. We treated them like prisoners. Then came the Changing of the Hearts and Mind campaign in 2008 of February. We left in August. The camp closed down soon after. They were released and sent to Ramadi. The Iraqi government collapsed after we left, and all of those Takfiri buddies turned around and met back up via Syria. Their network is far and wide, and they don't care if you give a about their refugees or their children. All that does is give them a wider gateway. Don't fall for the humanity of freedom. It is being exploited in our face. They are here right now, and it's just a matter of time. Good luck to all. In fact, even reported the fact that many of the men who were Saddam Hussein's mid-level officers and higher up were in these camps and now have been brought into ISIS. You ask the question, how are these people trained? Who's funding these people? Where are they getting all this money from? Well, you might be shocked. Vladimir Putin wasn't. It's amazing that Vladimir Putin has become almost the voice of reason in the midst of all of this. This past week, he has said time and again, but he revealed information that Western media will not air. 2 months ago, he provided information illustrating that ISIS is being funded by the West. And he's making more noise and made more noise at the G20 summit that took place in Turkey, where he shared intelligence data on the Islamic State financing with his G20 colleagues. RT Times reported during the summit, Putin said, I provided examples based on our data on the financing of different Islamic states units provided by private individuals. The money, as we've established, comes from 40 countries, and there are some of the G20 members among them. One of the ISIS leaders, Yusuf al-Salafi, was caught in Pakistan, and he admitted that ISIS is being funded by the United States and thus the Obama administration. This came from a statement done by the Pakistani government, which interrogated Yusuf and received this information from him. The investigation said Yusuf al-Salafi revealed that he was getting funding routed through the United States to run the organization in Pakistan and recruit young people to fight in Syria. One source said that al-Salafi confessed that he and another ally said to be an imam was getting paid by the United States to recruit youth to join ISIS for $600 a recruit. Same source says that the U.S. has been condemning the ISIS activities, but unfortunately has not been able to stop funding of these organizations, which is being routed through the United States. The United States has to dispel the impression that it is financing the group for its own interest, and that that's why it launched its offensive against the organizations in Iraq, but not in Syria. It came out back in 2012 that U.S., Turkey, and Jordan were jointly running a United States CIA and Special Forces Command training base for Syrian rebels out of the Jordanian town of Safawi. But apparently, according to Jordanian officials, the training wasn't meant to be used in Iraq. The Syrian rebels that were being trained by our guys ultimately would join the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They were trained by United States instructors working at secret bases in Jordan, according to Jordanian officials. The officials said dozens of future ISIS members were trained at the time as part of a covert aid to the insurgents targeting the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Syria. The officials said the training was not meant to be used for any future campaign in Iraq. A lot of individuals over here are funneling money over there. There are a lot of good guys here who are trying to stop what's going on. But you also have a lot of people in places of authority who are turning their head, either knowingly or ignorantly. They can't do this just on their own. With all of the things that have come out in the news recently about the refugees, we say, oh, what about all the refugees? And, you know, they say, well, this is going to be used to funnel in a lot of the bad guys. But see, here's the thing. Once you understand Islam, if a person is committed to Islam, there is no way on God's green earth that it is a religion of peace. Don't believe that. But again, you say, I've known Islamic people who are peaceful people who won't do that. Here's why. Number one, either they're Islamic, but they really don't know what they believe, like a lot of people who take the title Christian, or they're hypocrites. They do know what they teach, but refuse to adhere to it. And according to ISIS, they deserve to die. You cannot be but any one of those two things. You're either ignorant of what it teaches and not commit and not don't know, which many times, because most of the prayers and the sayings are only done in Arabic, so a lot of them don't understand the real meaning of what's really behind it. And it's a title only, a name, and that's what they grew up being, you know, just like a lot of us, well, I'm a Baptist because that's what I grew up being, but they really know what they believe. Or they're being hypocrites. They know, but they're not going to practice it. That's the only two. Anybody else is committed to this. Period. And so, these folks, you say, well, what about all these people coming into the country, so on and so forth? And it's so hypocritical. Where so many Christians who have been trying to flee Syria, read the news report, so many Christians who have been trying to seek refuge here are being refused by this administration. Denied by this administration, but Islamic, particularly young men between the ages of 18 and 35, not a lot of women and children, are trying to be funneled in and are still being brought in very surprising ways. If you read the testimonies of men who have served over there, people who have lived in that culture, we have friends who've been missionaries in Afghanistan, and talk to you about the way of life and what these people believe. If I have a testimony from an army medic, how that sexual perversion is practiced. And the reason why it's practiced is because Muhammad was a sexual pervert. He was a pedophile. He had sex with little children. He had sex with little boys. He had sex with his own children. He had multiple wives. He was a vicious, murdering, thieving, conniving, lying deceiver. But he's the standard. These people over there, men, have regular sex with boys on a daily basis. They believe that women are for children, boys are for pleasure. That's their statement. They call them chai boys, tea boys, servant boys. Recently, you may have seen in the news, our soldiers were told to turn their head away when little boys were being raped by these men, because that's considered culturally okay. Children being abused, hot water thrown in their faces for disciplinary actions. This medic talked about seeing these people brought into their places where they were on front forward operating bases, and people, these children being brought in with burnt faces, burnt skin, because the parents threw hot boiling water on them to discipline them. Or children, little girls being brought in because they've been abused so violently by rape by these men. And this is considered normal and okay. 97% of the rapes that are taking place right now in Sweden and in Europe are being conducted by immigrants who've been brought in from the Middle East. Why? Because it's considered the norm. Gang raping. Police won't even go to certain areas in these locations because of it. They're afraid they won't come out alive. So we've got to stop and sit back and think, what are we going to do here? How are we going to, and at the same time, you're trying to balance the Christian way of approaching people in love and so on and so forth. Trying to find a way and navigate through all this certainly is not going to be an easy job. What is the goal of all of this? Ultimately, from their standpoint, Islamic standpoint, it's terror and chaos. That's what the goal is. They want to create enough confusion and create enough chaos where people live in fear, ultimately where they're able to exercise control and bring in Sharia law. But because people like George Soros and others, well-financed people, wealthy people in the background who are financing a lot of this, they have a deeper agenda. They're trying to manipulate a lot of these people for a lot of other things to bring this nation down, to bring this nation into such chaos and disruption economically, to ultimately where we will be willing to submit to some other form of government and law. And don't think it can't happen. I had a friend of mine who's in law enforcement up north. He sent me a message this week, and he just simply said this. He said, listen, he said, you better start thinking from the standpoint of another angle where all this is headed and what's going on. And believe me, there's so much taking place behind the scenes that you don't even, and I don't even know about. He said, and if I were to tell you some of the things, you would not sleep at night. Here's the thing. Understand, think this. And he said, you better start thinking this way. If events happen and go down like so many are believing that they possibly could, and you have an event or events that take place across this nation, and you have the economic repercussions of it, and then you have the institution of martial law, think outside the box about where that goes toward November of 2016. And the possibility of that maybe not even happening. And he said, I'm telling you, I and a lot of my colleagues in this area feel the same way about it. There are things going on, he said, that ought to scare the living daylights out of us. And they're using these people to help bring that about. Chaos, confusion, fear, people willing to submit to whatever comes along. Listen, you got a whole city now that's living under martial law now for 3 months. You have Belgium, Brussels, Belgium, right now where the people weren't allowed to even go out of their homes because of fear of a chemical attack. Don't go out of your house. The goal of all this is to bring about change. How do we respond? As believers, we respond, obviously, we prepare ourselves spiritually in our walk with God. It's like people say, well, we need to have special teaching on how to prepare for persecution, blah, blah, blah. If a normal Christian life, living your life walking with Jesus, prepares you to live that way. Obviously, there's a different mindset. There's a different thing, obviously, when you start facing things that you've never faced before that you have to gear your mind up to and start thinking along those lines of what things life might be like. Should this happen? Should this take place? But we have to live our lives spiritually prepared in our walk with God, mentally prepared, thinking along these lines. Obviously, being more alert of where you go, things that are happening, things that are taking place around you, and how people are conducting themselves. It just makes good common sense. Physically prepared. And I've told you this before. We talked about it so many times. It's always wise to have a little extra food and water on hand. Not some, you know, crazy, weird prepping mentality kind of thing, although those people may not be as weird sometimes as we think, but to be prepared just in case, even if there's a natural issue or disaster that takes place, to be prepared that way. The bottom line is we ask, how do we apply the love of God in this? How do we demonstrate the gospel to these people, you know? Asking the question as we were discussing on Wednesday night, thinking about the possibility. Would you stand by lovingly and allow someone to do something to your wife or your children? How do you respond? Do you passively roll over and think that's what Jesus wants you to do? Or do you take a stand, even if it means cost your life, to defend those that you are responsible to take care of? I know where I fall at in that. But there are ethical and moral issues that every individual Christian is going to have to ask themselves and deal with, that we have to bring before the Lord to face in the reality of all this that we're dealing with right now. To share the gospel with them. And you'll see, most of the time, people who have come out of Islam, but ones that have converted to Christianity, they did not convert because somebody gave them 4 spiritual laws. They did not convert because somebody threw the Bible at them and hit them with a bunch of verses. They did not convert. They converted by simply observing the life and the way that believers interacted with themselves, among one another, how they treated people, how they dealt with people in a loving way. There are a lot of Islamic, or people who are former Islamic believers who are Christians now, who are even saying on this whole refugee situation, don't open the doors. Not that they're not being compassionate. They're saying you've got to approach this in a different way because, and I've seen it, having lived in a third world country, you can forge passports. I sat with a guy one day who had 5 different passports. who is working with drug trafficking. Five different passports. Every one of them got into five different countries. You can do all kinds of stuff if you've got the right means. You can forge a lot of things. And most of the time, you can't trace anybody back beyond so many years anyway. Even in Honduras, most of the kids didn't even know when they were born. There was no record of it. No paper trail, anything like that to verify or validate who these people really are. There's ways to go about it and ways that have to be thought through in a merciful and gracious, compassionate way. But I want to close this morning. We've got just a little video we're going to close with from a guy whose brother, known as Brother Rashid. He was a former Moroccan imam. He was a son of a former Moroccan imam, which is a religious leader in Islam, who specifically sent this message as a believer now in Jesus Christ. And I want you to hear what he has to say. And understand now, when you hear these things in the news, what you're dealing with, what these people are dealing with. But the fact is that we've got people in places of authority in this nation who have either, one, not a clue, and are trying to do things the wrong way because they don't understand how these people believe, or number two, who do know exactly what they are doing. And I believe there's a lot of them who know exactly what they are doing and are intentional in it. And I believe the man that sits in the White House is one of them. I believe that he knows exactly what he's doing. He's not the fool everybody thinks that he is. And I can tell you that he is no lover of Christianity. Not at all.
ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim. And ISIL is certainly not a state.
Dear Mr. President, with all due respect, sir, I must tell you that you are wrong about ISIL. You said ISIL speaks for no religion. I'm a former Muslim. My dad is an imam. I spent more than 20 years studying Islam. I hold a bachelor's degree in religious studies, and I'm in the middle of my master's degree in terrorism studies. I can tell you with confidence that ISIL speaks for Islam. Allow me to correct you, Mr. President. ISIL is a Muslim organization. Its name stands for Islamic State. So even the name suggests that it is an Islamic movement. Their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, holds a PhD in Islamic studies. I doubt you know Islam better than he does. He was a preacher and a religious leader in one of the local mosques in Baghdad. ISIL's 10,000 members are all Muslims. None of them are from any other religion. They come from different countries and have one common denominator, Islam. They are following Islam's prophet Muhammad in every detail. They imitate him by growing their beards, shaving their mustaches, and in the way they dress. They follow his command in the hadith to differentiate themselves from the infidels by wearing their watches on the right instead of the left hand. They implement Sharia in every piece of land they conquer. They pray five times a day. They have called for a caliphate, which is a central doctrine in Sunni Islam, and they are willing to die for their religion. They are following the steps of Islam's prophet Muhammad to the letter. By the way, if you want to understand ISIL, read the oldest biography of Muhammad by Ibn Hisham. This is their model for action. You think that ISIL does not speak for Islam because they beheaded an American and they killed those whom they consider infidels. In the same way, Islam's prophet Muhammad beheaded in one day between 600 and 900 adult males in a Jewish tribe called Banu Qurayza. In fact, beheading is commanded in the Quran in Surah 47, the fourth verse. It says, "When you meet the unbelievers in fight, smite at their necks Ironically, this surah is called the Surah of Muhammad. Killing prisoners is also an order from Allah to Muhammad and to all Muslims. It says, it is not for a prophet to have captives of war until he inflicts a massacre upon Allah's enemies in the land. Quran 8:67. And by the way, three of Muhammad's wives were Jewish girls he kidnapped from his raids on religious minorities, just as ISIL is doing today. Mr. President, I grew up in Morocco, supposedly a moderate country, yet I still learned at a young age to hate the enemies of Allah, especially Jews and Christians. These are represented today by Israel and the West, especially the great Satan, America. I prayed 5 times a day, repeating Al-Fatiha, the first chapter in the Quran, asking Allah to lead me not in the way of those who went astray and those who have the wrath of Allah upon them. We all knew that it is Jews and Christians. We have been brainwashed to hate all of you in our sacred texts, in our prayers, in our Friday sermons, in our educational systems. We were ready to join any group that one day would fight you and destroy you and make Islam the religion of the whole world, as the Quran says. This is what I and millions like me have been taught. Mr. President, this is an irrevocable fact. Fortunately, when I grew up, I chose to leave Islam and became a Christian because I believed that God is love. Others also left, and still every day they are leaving Islam and choosing different paths for their lives. All of them are suffering today because, again, Islam's prophet Muhammad said, whoever changes his religion, kill him. I left Morocco under persecution. I was fortunate. Others throughout the Muslim world do not have the same opportunity. They are paying a heavy price in different ways in order to get their freedom one day. I ask you, Mr. President, to stop being politically correct, to call things by their names. ISIL, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, the Taliban, and their sister brand names are all made in Islam. Unless the Muslim world deals with Islam and separates religion from state, we will never end this cycle. Until you deal with the root of the problem, we'll be just dealing with the symptoms. ISIL is just one symptom. If it disappears, other ISILs will be born under different names. You might ask, then why does ISIL kill other Muslims? The answer is that they consider them infidels, not Muslims. Do you know that all 4 schools in Islam agree that if a Muslim stops praying, he should be asked to repent, and if he does not, he should be killed? Do you know that Muhammad tried to burn his own companions when they stopped coming to prayers? So anything that qualifies a Muslim to be an infidel can be a reason for killing him, even neglecting to pray. If Islam is not the problem, then why is it that there are millions of Christians in the Middle East and yet none of them has ever blown up himself to become a martyr? Even though they live under the same economic and political circumstances and even worse. Why have many Muslims in the West also joined ISIL if Islam is not the reason? Why have even new converts to Islam become terrorists? Mr. President, if you really want to fight terrorism, then fight it at the root. How many Saudi sheikhs are preaching hatred? How many Islamic channels are indoctrinating people and teaching them violence from the Quran and the Hadith? How many Friday sermons are made against the West, freedom, and democracy? How many Islamic schools are producing generations of teachers and students who believe in jihad and martyrdom and fighting the infidels? And finally, how many websites are funded by governments, your allies, that have sheikhs or issue fatwas against basic human rights. If you want to fight terrorism, start from there. By the way, I do not give my full name because Islam is a religion of peace. I'm known around the whole world as Brother Rashid, and I implore you to take a stand for international human rights and the future of democracy and speak the truth about the real threat that is facing all of us. Best regards, Brother Rashid.